Are you ready?
Yeah.
Are you with it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go. You know what to do. The whole world's watching and counting on you. And all you people listening out there, everybody, everywhere.
Hang on, hang on, hang on!
Welcome to Checkered Past, a loving postmodern examination of the Go-Go Check branded comic magazines published by DC Comics between February 1966 and August 1967. I'm Dr. Bob, and each week I'll be your guide on this trippy tour through 535 mid-century masterpieces of graphic noveldom.
This week, Action Comics number 345, cover date January 1967, cover price 12 cents, cover artist Kurt Swan and George Klein, edited by Mort Weisinger, featuring the day candid camera unmasked Clark Kent's identity, written by Leo Dorfman, art by Al Plastino, and The Exile of Steel, written by Jim Shooter, art by Jim Mooney. Are you ready? Are you with it? Then away we go!
See how the fluffy clouds move by us.
See how the clouds move by.
See how the morning mist can hide us away.
Hide us away. And now is so much fun. What?
Superman helps Alan Funt of the Candid Camera television show prank Perry White by making the Daily Planet building disappear. Following the stunt, Funt plans another prank to be broadcast live on TV. Using Perry as his accomplice, Funt's actors stage a robbery at the Metropolis Fair. When Clark Kent slips away to become Superman, Funt's cameras capture him in the act of switching clothes. Meanwhile, on the planet Gaia, Supergirl is imprisoned as a suspected agent of a revolutionary movement. Though she pleads her case at trial, she has no evidence to support her. The testimony of Dick Malvin, secretly an ARM agent, is enough to convict her. Confused? Don't worry, I'll be right back with Dr. Husband and a special guest to explain everything.
When it's least expected, you're elected, you're the star today. Smile, you're on Candid Camera.
With the hocus pocus, you're in focus.
It's your lucky day. Smile, you're on Candid Camera. It's fun to ask yourself. It's the comic drive who's true. It's fun to look at yourself as other people do. How's your sense of humor? There's a rumor laughter's on its way.
Listener, we have a special guest today, Dr. Chuck Coletta, professor of pop culture at Bowling Green State University of Bowling Green, Ohio. Chuck, welcome.
Hi, guys, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you.
We have been legitimized.
Yes.
Now, officially through academia.
The Academy will recognize us now.
I want to thank Dr. Chuck and all of the people who recommended us to this occasion.
Yes.
I wasn't prepared. I don't have a speech.
Oh, no. You didn't expect to win.
No.
My first question is, how did you get my dream job?
I lucked into well, my background is in English literature. I've got a master's in English lit. And then I went to law school for a year and hated it, every minute of it. And then I found out about the Department of Popular Culture at Bowling Green State University, which was founded by a man named Dr. Ray Brown back in the 60s.
Mm.
And we define it as the culture of everyday life. So it's television, it's movies, it's local theater productions and local bands. It's all that kind of stuff. And thank God for Ray Brown, because I'm teaching a class on movie history this semester and television history. I'm teaching a class in the fall on comic books and superheroes. You can come to Bowling Green and write your dissertation on the Beverly Hillbillies or anything that you want.
You want to get a fifth degree, right?
Yeah, I do need a fifth degree.
Right.
Well, we're having two conferences later this year. We're having one on funk music, which I know nothing about. Mm-hmm. In the spring, and in the fall, we're having a conference on soap operas. So if you know anything about soap operas, come on up. It's free to come to the conference. So
are you doing telenovelas too?
Yes. Any kind, anything that's sort of serialized.
Oh my God.
Is there going to be any trivia contests?
If you want it, you can run it if you want. No, but we're going to have a soap opera expert, and we hope to have academic papers and fans. And we had a conference on Batman and one on Spider-Man in the last couple of years. So
I know that.
Oh, okay. So if you've ever watched Days of Our Lives or any of that, General Hospital.
Yes, we were an ABC soap family, so I know all about General Hospital and all my children.
He followed all the stories.
Yeah. I watched Dallas. When other kids were going to the football game at high school, I was watching Dallas. So.
Me too, and Dynasty. Yes.
So that's my life.
It sounds ideal. Well, Chuck, we invited you here today for a very specific reason, to discuss a figure of pop culture that probably no one alive today has heard about, except the three of us. Alan Funt, guest starring in Action Comics number 345. What do you know about Alan Funt?
Well, one of the things I did a little research, it seems like almost everybody who worked with him didn't like him. He was not he was not a nice guy, apparently, off camera. But Alan Funt was born in 1914. He died in 1999. And he started out on radio, and believe it or not, he used to work for Eleanor Roosevelt. He worked on Eleanor Roosevelt, had a radio show, and he did some writing for that.
Wow.
Before Candid Camera, it was Candid Microphone, which was a show that he started on while he was in the Army. He was in the Army, and they were doing radio shows on the Armed Forces Radio. Uh-huh. And they went to radio, and then he was like right on TV in the late 1940s. He was one of the very first TV shows.
Wow. And then he had a long career with that, didn't he?
Right. He did it up until the end, and his son was doing it years later. And I did not realize this, but I have to search it out. But he made a candid camera movie in the early 1970s. It's called What Do You Say to a Naked Lady? And it's candid camera with nudity.
I don't like the sound of that.
I looked it up. It said full frontal male and female nudity.
What?
And a lot of sex talk. It's mostly sex talk, I guess, but with Alan, honest to God.
Oh my God.
Well, it wasn't on TV.
Not on TV.
Yeah.
But he claims, I'll just end with this. He claimed that he was the father of reality TV late in life. And I don't know if that's exactly true, but he was up there. He was in there.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. And it's so interesting to think that the man who made a living as America's funny guy, you know, bringing these hilarious capers of making a living of basically what I would love to do, which would be playing pranks on people.
Yeah.
Harmless pranks, obviously, was not a pleasant man to work with.
No. If you read these stories, like in sort of pop culture, there are certain people that everybody loved. Everybody says nice things about Jack Benny, for example, or like Norman Lear. And everybody says terrible things about Danny Kaye and Alan Funt. Oh, he was a pain in the ass. I hated that guy. But he was just, I guess he wasn't the guy that you saw on TV all the time. He was kind of a tough guy.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I only remember him from the 70s. There was a syndicated version of Candid Camera, right?
Right. And when you least expect it, you're elected. It's your lucky day. Hey, smile. You're on Candid Camera.
That's it.
I didn't remember all the lyrics.
Oh, I can sing the bridge.
Okay.
It's fun to laugh at yourself. It goes on and on. Yeah.
With wasn't Joanne Flew on his co-host on there?
I think so. Yeah, he had a couple of co-hosts. He had Durwood Kirby was a co-host, and there were a couple of other ones over the years, I guess. But he was the main one. There's a clip that you can watch on YouTube I found where he's interviewing kids in a high school, like a guidance counselor, and he's telling the one kid like that you should be a farmer, and it turns out it's Richard Lewis, the comedian Richard Lewis. And he's like 14 or 15, and he's like devastated. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? My mom wants me to be a lawyer. And He's exactly. So he was doing that kind of stuff.
What network carried Candid Camera when we were watching it? Because I remember I would watch Candid Camera and Real People.
It was syndicated, so it just probably depends on your
local market, right?
Well, yeah. Well, believe it or not, I did look this. This was in the notes I had. It was syndicated, but it was one of the few shows that it's been on all the networks. It's been on ABC, CBS, NBC, and this era, this 1960s era, it was on CBS on Sunday nights.
Okay.
And it followed. Let me see. It followed. The CBS Sunday Night lineup was Ed Sullivan, the Smothers Brothers, and then Candid Camera.
Wow.
At 10 o'clock.
Nice. What was it up against?
It was up against NBC was up against the Andy Williams Show. But the Andy Williams lead-in was Bonanza. And Bonanza was the number one rated show in America that year, for those couple of years.
Okay.
And then ABC, it was the ABC Sunday Night Movie and the FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist Jr.
Is that Stephanie Zimbalist's father?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, you've listened to our show. You know the routine. Just say whatever you want, whether it has anything to do with the comic or not.
Yes, totally unscripted. Tangents are absolutely welcome.
Oh, good. Good.
You'll be glad to know that we have 6 inches of snow on the ground, but the walkers have already been through the neighborhood. So hopefully we won't have any barking dogs.
And I did have my nap already.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's like 2 degrees here. I'm up in northeastern Ohio. I'm in Cleveland at the moment, but everything's going to be shutting down the next couple of days.
Yeah, we have that weather. We have a winter weather warning right now for the snowstorm, which should stop around 7 o'clock, and then the cold air coming through. Like tomorrow morning, it's supposed to be wind chill of -15 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Bob.
All right. Action Comics number 345, January 1967. 40 million viewers see it happen on TV.
The day Candid Camera unmasked Clark Kent's identity.
Then we hit the flash page, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Since he began his super career, Clark Superman Kent has used every dodge in the book to keep his dual identity a secret. Everyone from Luther to Lois Lane has tried to uncover his alter ego and failed. But now along comes Alan Funt, creator of TV's wildest half hour, Candid Camera, to catch Clark in the act of changing to his super self before an audience of 40 million televiewers on...
We already did this.
Oh, the day Candid Camera unmasked Clark's identity. I just remembered something that I read.
What?
So I don't remember the year, but there was a plane that was hijacked, and the hijackers wanted to go to Cuba, and Alan Funt and his family were on the plane.
Yes.
And because the rest of the passengers recognized him, they thought it was a gag for Candy.
Oh, my God.
Until the moment they landed in Cuba.
Wow.
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 On Sunday night, like millions of Americans, editor Perry White watches his favorite TV show, Candid Camera.
So Alan Funt says, folks, for our next stunt, one of our staff is entering the gorilla cage at the zoo. Now watch what happens when the next visitor comes along. I think that Alan Funt had kind of like a working man's kind of voice. I don't remember him being...
Yeah, it was kind of a gangster voice.
Yeah, gangster. So what is this gag we're dealing with here?
Well, they've put a human being inside of the gorilla cage, a human being dressed in a morning suit and top hat.
Yeah, and so the guy's buying peanuts for his kid to give to the gorilla, and he ends up giving it to a man dressed in top hat. And a
yes.
Man. Yeah.
Maybe it's Congo Bill being taken over by the Congorilla personality.
I thought that was a silly thing to do. I thought they would put a person in a chimp suit. And then maybe I thought if they wanted to do something along the lines of what they would do in Candid Camera, the person would dress in a chimp suit or a gorilla suit and do something like vacuum the cage or do dishes or something like that.
See, you should be writing for television.
Yeah, but obviously I missed my calling. Yeah.
Meanwhile, the man says there's the passerby says there's a man in the gorilla cage and everyone else is pretending like they don't see it.
Yeah, that's the joke.
Classic candid camera. Then, of course, Alan Funt reveals himself and says, smile, it's all a gag. You're on Candid Camera and we'll play the tape of you on our show next Sunday night. Very little lead time, apparently.
1 week.
1 week
to turn it around.
From filming to broadcast.
Well, that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just then, Perry White receives a call. There's been a spectacular holdup at the Daily Planet, and he's got to rush right down because, as we read in the next panel, the entire staff of this great metropolitan newspaper is home for the weekend.
Nothing happens on the weekend.
No.
But I want to pause for a moment just to notice, okay, in that panel with Perry White, when you hear the ring ring,
yeah.
He says, oh, no, the phone, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no, the phone. Now, later on, when he gets a call at work, he also gets very anxious and runs to the phone. Is Perry White not used to answering the phone?
Well, let's see. It's 1967. He's about... 60 years old, 55?
Yeah.
Surely he was in the war.
Yeah.
So he's probably got PTSD, so every time he hears loud ring.
Okay. So we're on the page now where we're looking at the exposed basement of the Daily Planet.
No, let's just say the foundation, because it's a slab foundation. There is no basement.
Okay.
Of the great metropolitan skyscraper newspaper. Great Caesar's ghost, the entire planet building is gone. Nothing left but a hole in the ground. Am I having a nightmare? Am I losing my mind? Is my PTSD catching up with me?
God bless him. So he stops the police, right?
Yeah, flags down a police car.
I want to report a missing building.
Oh, you mean the Daily Planet? There's been a temporary change of address. Just look straight up.
Great floating flounders. It's Superman flying around with the Daily Planet building.
This is my favorite panel. Superman, you idiot. Put that building back at once.
Now, I'm no engineer, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, this thing about Superman picking up buildings and moving them around.
Yes.
Is it possible that you can support an entire building by picking it up on the corner?
Well, I believe that's been explained in later years, that he has some kind of telekinetic force field that
allows
him
the building to remain intact.
Pick up a giant building by one corner.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I don't know. I might have just made that up.
I'm glad it's explained in comic science.
And there's no crime, I guess, going on. Superman has got enough time to be a guest on the Candid Camera TV show, so...
Yeah, well,
no crime on Earth or any other planet.
If you can send the entire newspaper staff home for the weekend, clearly nothing happens.
Slow news.
Metropolis just rolls up the sidewalks at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. After Superman replaces the skyscraper, Perry demands to know what the gag is. Superman just wanted to see how he'd respond to a super emergency, and now we know.
That's it.
And now Perry, smile, you're on Candid Camera.
Oh, I love that show.
There's Alan Funt himself. You will notice that Alan Funt has exactly the same face in every panel. They probably just photostated and reversed.
Yeah, he does. It's a very good likeness of him.
Yes. Although, was he always old? Like, to me, he looks exactly like he did in the 70s.
He did. He does. You're right. I didn't think of that.
Or is it like a Mickey Rooney situation where he was a child and then middle-aged and there was no in between?
Nothing in between, yeah.
Wow.
All right. This stunt has topped everything as far as Perry's concerned. And now Perry learns that he's going to be on TV in exactly 1 week.
Right. Oh.
America is delighted.
Interesting that the next page we go into, it says the following day, as the Funt staff meets, the Perry White sequence was a smash, Mr. Funt. Look at all that fan mail. Now, it aired on Sunday night.
Yes.
It's Monday morning.
Yes.
And all that mail's come in. How did they send that mail in?
Pneumatic mail tubes. Reverse the city.
Oh, God.
Now, Alan's Funt wants to try a similar stunt on the next show. And usually the stunts are filmed in advance, but he's got an idea for a live stunt featuring Clark Kent, ace reporter of the Daily Planet. And as the added twist is he's going to put the segment on live. So he's going to call Perry White and set it up. Meanwhile, Perry is receiving some good-natured ribbing by the staff of the Daily Planet.
Yes, they put fish in the water cooler.
Classic.
Yeah.
Jimmy's lighting his cigar with a blowtorch.
Classic Jimmy.
While Lois creeps around taking pictures of everything. Lois, Jimmy, and Clark all declare that they could not be fooled by Alan Funt.
And that's when they all say, nope. And that's when, where is it? What the hell's his name?
Who?
Perry. Perry White. Yeah, Perry White says, he says, oh no, my phone! Again, the PTSD kicking in.
Ring, ring.
Ah!
It's Alan Funt on the phone. He's securing Perry's agreement to help with a stunt.
Right.
And Perry agrees because now his staff has been ribbing him all day long and he's ready to get some revenge.
Indeed.
What he's to do is assign Clark to cover the annual Metropolis Fair at the Coliseum on Sunday night and assign him to the Gay 90s exhibit at 10:45 p.m. What was I going to say about 10:45? Oh, did people routinely watch television communally late at night in the 60s?
Well, you know, that's one of the things we talk about a little bit in my TV history class. This is probably the era when people only had one television in the house, maybe two.
Right.
They used to call it the electronic hearth, like you're sitting around the fireplace. Mm. But TV shows back in the 50s and 60s had to have mass appeal. You had to be, you know, you had an audience of 8-year-olds and 80-year-olds all sitting there together. So maybe they were. This is pretty late in the 60s, though, for them to still only have one TV. But
I'm just thinking, like, didn't people have jobs that they had to get up in the morning for?
10:45 p.m. How many people are going to tune in that late?
Well, I do love What's My Line, and I know it aired at 10 or 10:30 at night.
Oh, God, he loves What's My Line. Have you ever seen What's My Line?
Yes, yes.
Oh, are you in the theater?
This is not What's My Line, but one of my favorite clips of an old TV game show is I've Got a Secret from the 50s. And they bring out the oldest little old man that you've probably ever seen in your entire life.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And his secret was he saw the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Yes.
He was in the theater at the time. He was like a kid, and he was still alive to see that.
Oh. Go watch that later, Rob.
Okay.
I know exactly where it is on YouTube.
Awesome.
See? you could teach this stuff. You could take over.
The syllabus would be somewhat limited to game shows, soap operas, and comic books, but yes.
If you ever need a sub.
Maybe a seminar on the Judy Garland show. I could do that. In the days that follow, as Alan Funt and his staff prepare for their weekend show, for example, having a car filled up at the service station and it floats into the air like a balloon.
Yeah.
What a gag.
I even see how they explain it in the, you know.
They explain it in great detail.
They do. I mean, helium, they must have stripped everything possible out of that VW bug to make it float.
They have a compressed helium tank, a helium gas bag, and a helium discharge exhaust in this lightweight car. This service station attendant can't wait to see himself on the show next week, exactly 1 week.
Do you guys remember when there were service station attendants? I remember when we first saw people, when we went on a trip to Disney World in the 70s and down south, you pumped your own gas. We were shocked. As kids, oh my God! Look at these hillbillies—they're pumping their own gas. We yes.
Yeah, I remember you used to go to the, and they would check your oil and they would fill your windshield washer fluid and check your coolant, everything. Yeah.
And then bring a little clipboard over, run your charge plate.
Run your charge plate. Yes, and clean your windshields and everything.
Although, why do you need to charge gas? Because it was 5 cents a gallon.
Who knows?
Then nearby at a winter festival in Metropolis Park, there's some people making snow sculptures and some hooligans throwing snowballs to wreck the sculptures. And then one comes to life. It's a snow spaceman.
They're running away. And of course, the children are running away. And then Alan Funt comes out with his camera. He says, you're on candid camera. I wanted my fans to see you react when the snowman started to walk.
You mean we're going to be on your show? Wow.
My mother would not be very pleased with any of these people.
Mm-mm.
At the winter festival with no heavy parkas on.
She got pneumonia weather.
It's pneumonia weather. And Alan Funt is strolling around with just a suit jacket.
Mm.
Alan Funt buys these hoodlums hamburgers and Cokes. And off they go.
There we go. Now, I want to pause for a second.
Yes.
Dr. Chuck, have you ever played or had a joke, a prank played on you at work or anything like that?
No, I'm a bad sport. We could not. My family, we did not play board games. We'd end up throwing them at each other. We did not. We just watched television and stayed in our own own sections. We didn't do anything fun. That we had to participate in. We just sort of watched people do things. We didn't play games or.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, I'm.
I come from a family of pranksters.
Oh.
Like my grandmother was like 5'2", and my grandfather was about 6 feet tall, maybe 6'1", and she used to throughout their entire marriage, on no regular schedule whatsoever. She would sneak into the bathroom when he was in the shower and pitch a big glass of ice water over the shower curtain onto him in the shower. And she was just a wonderful little precocious woman. And then I have played pranks on my colleagues at work. Some of them, like I got seven electronic digital crickets. And little tiny little things. And I hid them all over my colleague's office and they would go off intermittently in any time between 1 and 20 minutes. And they would last for weeks. And I hid them all over his office in the ceiling tiles, everything. And he was forever trying to find those. And then my favorite one was, I am really bad about keeping quiet about it too. Like I really, like once it happens, I just laugh and laugh. I tied a bell underneath my assistant's chair at work. And so she would, and it would only ring every time she would move in her chair, and she couldn't figure out where it was coming from. And the best thing was I was standing there watching when she was in the chair and she's turning and she goes, "Where's that coming from? Where's that coming from?" And every time she turned, it would ring and I lost my mind. I was crying with laughter. I loved that. We did some great pranks over the years.
They would call human resources today at the office over at our school. They would.
No fun. I'm known for my pranks. They did a great prank on me once. They took a carousel horse and brought it into my office and then tied streamers to it. And there were streamers going from it and balloons all across the top of my office. So as soon as I opened the door, the very first thing I saw was this carousel horse and all these streamers. And I screamed. I jumped back and screamed. I didn't know what it was. It was hilarious. And then the carousel horse was on wheels. So then I got on the carousel horse and they rode me through the hallways. It was a blast.
Boy, I wish I worked there.
Ever since then, he gets startled every time the phone rings.
Oh, no, the phone. Okay. Nice little sidewalk.
Now, Clark has arrived to his assignment at the fair. I'm sure I've mentioned on this program that my father would take his summer vacation to work at the Ohio State Fair. Oh. And whatever his job was, it involved driving around in a golf cart all day. And my father could and would talk to every person he met. So he knew all the cattlemen and Uncle Sam on stilts and the butter cow sculptor. And
he wouldn't let you go on the rides.
No, because he saw the rides being assembled. So we were not allowed to go. No.
On the rides. We would never be able to go on the rides. My mom would not allow that. Those carnies, you can't trust them. You can't trust them.
It's not the carnies. They would hire kids off the street and give them a quarter and have them climb the rigging, screw in the rides.
Have you ever Googled carnival fail videos?
No, but I'm going terrifying. To as soon as we log off.
Never, ever ride a carnival ride.
Oh.
Ever. No.
It's almost time for Clark to visit the Gay 90s exhibit.
Right. What page are you on now?
Not before starting at the 100 years of progress from horse car conductor to astronaut exhibit and the superhero
Haven shop.
Souvenir shop.
Page 9, yeah.
Now, what Clark doesn't know is that he's being broadcast live on television on a candid camera. And at the Gay 90s exhibit, they have a live reenactment of the last official bare-knuckle boxing championship fight in 1889 between John L. Sullivan and Jake Kilrain. It's an actual fight. They fought for 75 rounds.
75 rounds?
Bare-knuckled.
How long is a round?
I don't know. 30 seconds?
a minute.
I didn't know there would be sports trivia.
I didn't either, but 75 rounds.
Yes.
He must have looked horrible by the end of that.
Well, you know, I don't imagine many boxers in the 19th century looked like much to start with. And in the second Gay 90s tableau, Perry told him to cover a portrayal of the famous Diamond Jim Brady, who could polish off several lobsters, a brace of roast ducks, and half a ham in one sitting, and then top it off with a few pies.
Now, why was Diamond Jim Brady famous?
Because he wore a diamond?
I did look this up. He was sort of like a one of the key figures of the Gilded Age. He was like a rags to riches kind of story.
Sure.
I thought it was kind of weird that they're doing like a Gay 90s story in the late 60s. I wouldn't know who any of these characters were if I were a little kid. John L. Sullivan and, well, Diamond Jim, maybe you've heard that name, but it seems like an odd thing to pull out. That's the historical period that they're going to focus on in this little story here.
It's weird because you think of like, okay, so parents are going to be taking their kids to these, and the parents are going to be in their 40s maybe, so they wouldn't have been alive during the Gay 90s.
No.
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, although, you know, I think you hit on something when you said that everyone was sitting around the same television watching the things. Like, there was, before cable television, there was sort of a communal knowledge of pop culture of past eras.
Right.
If you weren't watching new shows, you were watching Bugs Bunny or The Little Rascals.
That's right. You know, like I was telling somebody, I knew who some of the old movie stars were from. They showed up on the Bugs Bunny cartoons. You would see Greta Garbo walk through. And like, for example, I always tell my students, my grandfather was born in 1900. So he was, that's like only 75 years earlier, John Adams was still alive.
Yeah,
and we knew who like Charlie Chaplin was as a kid in the 80s. He was doing IBM commercials and the things. So there's much more historical rep. Maybe you're right. Maybe the 1890s wasn't so off the mark.
Have you ever seen the episode in the first season of The Lucy Show where Lucy's daughter Chris wants to host a New Year's Eve party and Lucy insists that she and Viv provide the entertainment? And so they do a Charlie Chaplin routine.
Oh.
And poor Chris has to gather her teenage friends and say, all right, everybody, have a seat. My mom and her friend Viv are going to do their famous Charlie Chaplin routine.
Oh, God.
Ugh.
Yes, my grandmother also was born in 1902. And my mother was alive during the golden age of Hollywood. So I knew all the old stars when they popped up on Love Boat.
Yeah.
We do learn that the actor playing Diamond Jim wore jewels which belonged to the real Diamond Jim. For safekeeping, these gems are locked in a vault between performances, but not before these boxing actors get a hold of them, because in they burst with guns.
They're going to take the jewels. the sparklers.
Now, luckily Clark Kent is there. We know he's Superman and is going to put a stop to this nonsense. But unbeknownst to Clark, the TV cameras are still on him. The gag is that they're going to follow Clark into the telephone booth, which is not connected, and they're going to open the phone booth and find a frustrated reporter trying to call in a scoop on a dead phone. What they don't expect is to open the phone booth and find Clark Kent ripping his shirt off with Superman's uniform underneath.
Yeah.
Smile, Clark, you're on candid camera.
What?
You'll gulp.
A nationwide audience watches, absolutely stunned. So Clark is Superman, just as I always suspected. That was Lois
Lane.
That
was Lois. She knew it.
Yeah.
Some other criminal in a dingy apartment is delighted to see Clark squirm. And this young lad in his family's living room is concerned about what Superman's going to do about his new secret identity.
Well, so Alan Funt goes on to explain, Superman, that robbery was a fake. I was planning a hoax on Clark Kent. I never suspected.
Relax, Alan. Don't press the panic button.
Relax, he says. I have some news for you, Superman. This was a late live telecast. 40 million people saw the switch from Clark Kent to the Man of Steel.
Really? What makes you think I'm Superman?
Wow, people are watching this conversation happen live on television.
So he continues to strip his clothes off. Urging the audience not to jump to any conclusions until you see what's underneath my pants.
Oh, my God.
Why, he's wearing Batman pants and a utility belt and boots.
What?
Crazy. I could be Superman or Batman or just plain Clark Kent wearing parts of two costumes. Take your pick, Mr. Funt. Alan Funt gets it. You discovered that I was going to rib you on television and decided to turn the tables on me. But who let the cat out of the bag?
Well, you did, because you forgot one thing, that like millions of other Americans, I'm one of your fans. I had this miniature TV set tuned in on your show and was listening to the sound while I carried it in my pocket. So you yourself tipped me off. It's done. So there's a tiny...
I did not look this up. Is this a true thing that there were tiny little television sets?
I don't think so. This is the one thing that sort of takes me out of the story. There were no handheld TV sets.
No.
I remember we had a TV that you plugged in with batteries in the early 80s. It was sort of a little black and white thing with an antenna. But if this existed, I never heard about it.
Yeah, right. And it was the size of a toaster, probably.
Yeah.
Well, in a universe where we believe that lexophones are a real thing, I suppose this is okay.
I suppose. So Clark ducked the cameras. Camera slipped into the Heroes Haven souvenir shop. And top. You can mix and match. Or Garanimals.
Dr. Chuck, do you remember Garanimals?
I do. And I remember Underoos. I had underwear that's fun to wear. I remember that. And I would wear them now if they sold them. I would buy them. But I
don't know why. I mentioned Garanimals last week to someone. It was something about clothes not matching. And I said, well, if only they had Garanimals. And the person stared at me blankly, not understanding what it was. And I said, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, you weren't of that generation where they actually sold clothing with little animal characters like little polo emblems on the top and the bottom, and you'd match the hippopotamus with the hippopotamus and the dog with the dog.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
I remember also, the Sears had the husky size. Do you remember they had the husky size? they wouldn't do that today, but... there was an ad I found for... some, I think it was girls' clothes, and they were called Chubettes. Chubbetts, like Chubettes.
I can't believe that.
I do.
Oh.
You know the family I grew up in. I'm sure there was some of those in our house.
Yeah.
I'm also certain someone makes adult underoos today. I'm going to look into it.
Yeah.
Well, Alan Funt... is sure been fooled, and a worried nation relaxes with a sigh of relief. Thank heavens it was only a gag. Superman's secret identity is his greatest weapon in his war against crime and evil. Whew. Now, as Clark, as the TV crew packs up and Clark makes his way back to the office, he's thinking that Alan Funt doesn't dream how close he came to unmasking him. He didn't tumble onto the fact that he was on television until the last possible second.
Indeed.
He thought the theft was the real thing, so he was in the booth switching to Superman, but he still had his super hearing trained on the robbery and heard Alan Funt declare that it's a phony.
Mm-hmm.
And as he was trapped in the phone booth, microseconds away from being discovered, what else could he do but burrow under the phone booth at super speed, fly to Jimmy's apartment, where he knows Jimmy has a spare Batman costume in his disguise trunk, fly back to the phone booth, presumably repair the hole in the floor, put on Batman's pants, and receive Mr. Funt as he opens the door.
Amazing. That'll happen within a matter of seconds.
Yes.
Yeah. Why didn't he just disappear?
Well, he says he could have just, you know, gotten back, dressed back up as Clark Kent at super speed. But why, when you could do something much more elaborate and time-consuming? And play a joke on Alan Funt at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Next day in the Planet office, everyone has to acknowledge that that was a clever stunt you pulled on camera, candid camera, Clark. For a minute, I almost believed you were Superman.
Hmm. Clark, Superman, don't be ridiculous, Perry. Even though I myself suspect him of being Superman in every issue of my own comic magazine.
Well, all's well that ends well.
You know, the thing that I was thinking about when I read this is this story really shows you how different Marvel and DC were in the 60s.
Yes.
You know, Peter Parker and the angst and all of this, and this could have been written in the 40s. If you could have put it on radio or whatever. And I'm a DC kid. I was a DC kid, but I really see why Marvel started to take over. This, you know.
Now, are you on board for our backup Supergirl tale?
I am. This one was weird. This was a weird one, I thought.
Weird and
it's a two-parter, right?
Oddly timely.
Yes.
So this is continued from last issue where Supergirl was on, I don't know, summer break or Christmas break or something, and she flew to another planet, which is a duplicate of Earth, except instead of a White House, it has a greenhouse, and instead of adults ruling the world, teenagers rule the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
She stopped a gang of she stopped a gang of teenagers from arresting a group of adults and later learned that the teenagers were the police and the adults were the
anarchists
mm-hmm. trying to take over the government. So then she gave an impassioned speech at the presidential debates and was elected president of the whole planet as a write-in candidate.
Amazing. The power of television.
Yes.
And talk about timeliness. Mm.
Then she was discovered that she was actually Supergirl, mm-hmm. and she was thrown in jail, and the presidency was assumed by her vice president, Dick Melvin.
Who on Earth
is her boyfriend, Dick Malvern.
Malvern, yeah.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. So, yes, we get a little recap of this story I've just... Oh, and on this Earth, the orphans adopt their parents. So she adopted the couple who are duplicates for her adoptive parents back on Earth.
Okay.
Mr. and Mrs. Davis.
Okay. That's a nice recap. You just recapped 1, 2, 3 pages.
Sure.
Going right to the trial, right? Well, we should start with a discussion that she has with her attorney.
Well, yes, she's allowed to have an attorney. She explains that she didn't want to be president, and since I was wanted for helping those anarchists as Supergirl, I had to find a way to quit before someone discovered that Madam's president was secretly public enemy number one. Mm-hmm. And now she's in jail awaiting impeachment. And to make sure she doesn't escape, the authorities are holding her foster parents as hostages.
Wow. It's a rough life.
Now, the attorney believes her, and he's going to try to help her. He's got an odd haircut for a teenager.
Yeah, it's kind of like a bowl cut, isn't it?
It's a Guy Gardner special.
Yeah.
Next day, in the Senate chamber...
Madam President, you are charged with entering into the presidency under false pretenses, attempting to undermine the government, and many other serious charges. How do you plead?
Not guilty.
What?
Her lawyer says. What do you mean not guilty? I did those things, even though I didn't mean to.
He says, trust me, Linda.
I object. He doesn't really say that. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah.
Exhibit A for the prosecution, a series of photographs showing Supergirl or showing Linda changing to Supergirl and flying off, which conclusively proves that Linda Danvers is Supergirl, wanted for aiding would-be assassins and anarchists. No cross-examination, Your Honor.
Mm.
And as the second witness takes the stand,
he says, yes, close examination reveals that all her papers are faked and that she is not a natural-born citizen, as the qualifications for the presidency require. Well, we've never seen that in American history, have we?
No, but I have seen
like that
in the, I believe it's the Superman Encyclopedia from the 70s.
Mm.
It is stated that Superman cannot be elected president because he's not, he's just a naturalized citizen. He's not born in America.
He's not born in America, right.
And finally, Vice President Richard Malvin takes the stand. And this is what the lawyer's been waiting for.
Mr. Malvin, it was you who discovered that Miss Danvers was really Supergirl, was it not?
Yes, I came to her office. Wait, he's a teenager. Yes, I came to her office late one night to discuss business. But before I could knock, I heard her talking to a man who said he was an agent of ARM, the Adult Revolt Movement.
Then I heard Linda reveal that she was Supergirl and agreed to help ARM overthrow the government.
That's a lie. He's lying.
He's lying.
Order of the court.
Sit down, Linda. Remember, they still have the Davises in their custody. Her adopted parents.
Yes,
are in custody.
Well, naturally, I was shocked. Linda made me vice president, and I was still grateful, but my duty to my country came first. Then Supergirl is called for the defense and tells her story.
Just like she told it to her attorney.
Now, she finishes, and the prosecutor cross-examines. Aside from the utter absurdity of this testimony, can we take the word of this proven fraud and traitor? Surely no jury would believe her.
But every word is true.
This prosecutor looks like Brains from the Thunderbirds.
He does. Doesn't he?
Yes. The defense attorney asks for a recess to gather new evidence for the defense and are given, what, 12 hours to gather this evidence? That checks out.
Well, you went to law school, Chuck. Is that really how it works?
I didn't finish. I went. I didn't finish. So I can't.
What happened? Not enough time to gather evidence for your defense?
Honestly, I was there about 10 minutes, and I said, oh, my God, I've made a terrible mistake.
You know, I thought about going to law school seriously. After I finished my master's degree in voice performance, I was like, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to make a living in this. I mean, not two of us in our household, both of us performers. What am I going to do? I think I'll try law school. And then I looked into it seriously and said, no, that's not for me.
Oh, they were cutthroat. I was in a legal writing class, and by sheer coincidence, that's the time Dr. Seuss died that day.
Oh.
And somebody in class said to the teacher, well, I heard Dr. Seuss died. You know, what do you think about that? And honest to God, her reaction was, it's about time.
Oh,
I said, like, I can't be with these people. So,
these are not my people.
She wasn't kidding. She wasn't kidding. You know.
Well, what kind of a monster would have a vendetta against Dr. Seuss?
I don't know.
It's about time.
Wait, was her name Irene Vartanoff?
Oh, the snowplow.
What?
The snowplow's come
through. Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, okay.
You can write the check.
I should write the check right now.
The next day, the defense reports they have no new evidence. But we do know that the attorney has met with Supergirl, and he has an idea.
So that they call vote, and the Senate has a unanimous vote. The verdict is guilty. The sentence, the greatest the law allows, is that she's exiled from their shores forever, and her foster parents will remain prisoners until she obeys the sentence. Wow.
All right, then. Oh, sorry.
All right, then. Exile me from your stupid country.
She goes mad. She starts smashing up the Capitol building. She rips the dome off. She flies off into space. Goodbye forever. And good riddance. Notify all observatories to keep watch in case she returns.
She's gone. That's it.
That's it. However, it's all part of the plan.
It's all part of the plan. Well, we don't know it's all part of the plan. She's gone, right?
Well, it's all part of Dick Malvin's
plan. You're right.
Because now he's the president, and nobody knows he's a secret agent of ARM, and that by framing Linda, he has put his terrorist organization in control.
So he gives his secretary his list of new appointments. And the guy says, but sir, some of these are men suspected traitors, possibly connected with ARM.
That's crazy. A president couldn't submit a slate of new appointments that are known traitors and people working against America.
No,
nothing like that would
ever happens
happen
in a democracy, not in a republic. No.
No.
All part of Dick Malvin's plan to infiltrate the government with fellow agents.
So it starts.
Days later, this is straight up Nazi salute.
Mm-hmm.
The fools in the Senate blindly okayed my appointments. That's crazy. The Senate is there to advise and consent. They would never just blindly approve appointments to the cabinet.
Never.
That's what a fictional. That is DC in the 60s.
Wow. Isn't that wacky? That would never happen.
No. ARM now has control of all cabinet departments. And tomorrow is Dick's 20th birthday. He'll be out of his teens and legally an adult. So the adult coup takes place today.
Interesting that they said that he says to him, "You did your job well, Agent X2Y.
Yes.
Why did he call him that?
Because he's a secret agent. He's been working for ARM all the time.
Called by his name. He could have said, "You did well." Oh, there we go. The lights come on. Yeah.
Nazi salutes and Nazi uniforms marching through the streets. That's crazy. You'd never see Nazis marching through the streets these days.
No, you wouldn't certainly see people dressed up in the same kind of uniform and carrying a flag of unity that
certainly not in a nice place like Ohio.
No.
ARM controls the military. They've got tanks in the streets. They've taken over the Wilkinson, D.C. is under martial law. ARM has taken over the Supreme Court. That's crazy.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court is a separate branch of government. They'd never be under the control of one of the other branches.
No. And the Secretary of the Treasury is a traitor. He turned over all the funds to ARM. And finally, the Pentagon has been taken over by ARM. And so they now have the ability to launch nuclear missiles on any states that threaten them.
Crazy.
Oh, and now the teenagers have to have a curfew.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. That's a good point, actually. The oppression begins. With each passing day, the tyranny increases and the plight of the people grows greater. Some prisoners have tried to start an underground movement. Throw them in prison. No trial.
Right. They raise taxes and the kids complain the teenagers complain they don't have any more money and they just beat them up.
If you don't pay, we'll seize your home.
And then they decide to, throwing books and burning them in the streets.
Burning books. Books on democracy and constitutional law.
Yeah.
Crazy. Nothing like that would ever happen.
Nothing like that's ever happened in history.
No. Now, they converted the entire treasury to gold doubloons and have gathered it on the steps of the Capitol.
Well, it's inside, right?
I don't know. It's unclear to me.
Yeah.
Now nothing can stop ARM from taking over the world, except suddenly an earthquake, a hole opens in the ground, and all the money falls into the earth.
course, they blame saboteurs. Saboteurs yes. have crossed tunneled under the building and caused dynamite, used dynamite to cause a quake. And now, within minutes, the secret police round up suspects.
And string them up on the gallows. This would be pretty shocking for a child reading a comic book in the 1960s, wouldn't you think?
Well, I think so, except remember what happened in history. I mean, we're only a generation away from World War II.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it would be shocking. And I was surprised that they did this, that they went this far with Comics Code Authority, you know, and how strict they were about this.
But, right.
But yeah, remember what was in the popular conscience at the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
The suspects are tied. The nooses tightened around their necks. The trap doors drop, but surprisingly, all the ropes break. The prisoners are unharmed. Well, they might break a bone falling through the trap door.
Yeah.
And the crowd reacts by laughing at Dick Malvin.
Uh-oh.
Now, everyone knows that presidents of the United States cannot stand being laughed at in public. No one can get away with that. Well, guards line them up against a wall and form a firing squad.
Which they do.
Ha ha, I'm laughing now, senators. I'm having the last laugh. Fire!
And all the bullets miss them.
All the bullets miss. Dick Malvin takes the rifle himself. He's going to shoot all the prisoners dead. But just then, Supergirl arrives to save the day. But she was exiled. Where'd she come from?
She thinks to herself, I never thought I'd ever enjoy hitting anyone this much, especially someone who looks like Dick Malvin, my beau.
She gathers up Dick and his whoever was calling him Agent X2Y, and delivers them to the state prison. All the other anarchists have been already rounded up and put in the hoosegow. The teenagers regain control and are deeply indebted to Supergirl. But why did you return and save us after we banished you?
Well, you can thank Lucas Nevins, my attorney.
He became suspicious of Dick Malvin's motives at the trial when his testimony contradicted mine so. He believed my story and, doing some research on Dick's past, found some evidence of his affiliation with ARM. Next day, when I was sentenced, I pretended to be bitter and angry. Then I flew into space with the intention of returning as soon as Malvin showed his hand. But I spotted an emergency in a nearby solar system.
Great galaxies, that sun is expanding. It'll be completely engulfed. Several inhabited planets, unless I act fast.
So I didn't know that the Supergirl or Superman could actually do this. Like, actually.
Oh, my sweet summer child. Listener, if you don't have a visual reference, Supergirl is taking planets that are threatened by an expanding sun and tossing them like baseballs into a new orbit. Completely harmless to the inhabitants.
Wow.
Once she saved this solar system, she went right to work creating an earthquake under the Treasury building, letting all the money sink into the ground. But of course, she's going to return it to the people.
Of course.
Then, disguised as one of the girl senators, she attended the execution and severed the ropes with her heat vision, and a quick blast of her super breath changed the course of the firing squad's bullets. And that's my story.
Okay. Sticking to it.
Geez, Supergirl, you did all this despite the way we treated you. It'll take us some time to reorganize our government. Won't you stay on as acting president for the time being?
I wish I could, but a new college term will be starting soon on Earth, and I have to be there as Linda Danvers.
God bless her.
She is going back to school.
Presidency, spring semester. Presidency, spring semester. She made the right choice.
I didn't realize she was that old to go to college at this time. I sort of lost track of where she was. I thought she would have been in high school, but...
I think right about the time that she was adopted, she went to
start. Oh, okay.
I don't know.
Of course, we always love how she showed up on Earth and said, hi, Superman, I'm your cousin.
Hi, I'm your cousin.
And he throws her into an orphanage.
Well, there is time to reward her with a ticker tape parade. Long live the Maid of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the story, actually.
I did, too. I usually wouldn't like a story like this, but I don't know why.
Why? Because of the timeliness?
Well, they crammed a lot of, you know, this would take forever now. This is a lot of plot in, what, 10 pages or whatever it is.
Yes.
A lot.
Six or seven issues. Easily. Do we have a letter?
I'm sorry to report there is no letter from Irene Vartanoff in this issue.
Oh.
But look at this.
What?
Dear editor, in reply to Victoria Phillips' letter in the July action, I offer the following story of what might have happened if Super Baby had landed in the USSR instead of the USA.
Where are you?
I'm on the third letter. In 1936, a rocket from Krypton landed outside the Russian town of Malenkiselo, which is Russian for Smallville, in eastern Ukraine. The rocket and the baby inside were found by the Ivanovs, who named the baby Yuri and took him to their home where Mr. Ivanov ran a grocery. From Hitler's invasion of Russia in 1941 to 1946, Yuri and his family lived in abject poverty. With the close of the war, Yuri went to Kyiv, the Ukrainian capital, where he was apprenticed to a journalist. From there, he went to Moscow and became a reporter on the staff of Pravda, the Soviet Union's largest newspaper. With him there are Vera Shmiritrov, Ivan Shubayev, and editor Perisko Belil. He changes to Perikelovek in the Zapas Komnata and flies out to catch Prestupniki, which means criminals. Incidentally, it's unlikely that he would be a communist, since only about 4% of the population belong to the party. Is that true? I thought they had to belong to the party.
Yeah.
It's true that he would be taught from infancy that the communist way of life was the best in the world, but aren't American children taught the same thing about their government? What is this anarchist comic magazine?
Hmm.
The world's gone mad. Well, I tend to think Russia would have done better in World War II if they had Super Baby on the ground.
Hmm.
I read that Red Sun a long time ago, but I don't remember that. You know, so somebody must have been paying attention.
Yes. I wonder if he got credit. Also, we have to remember that Hitler had the Spear of Destinies, which prevented magic superheroes from interfering in the war.
Is that a comics thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, maybe real life. Watch some YouTube videos with me. Dr. Chuck, how can we thank you?
Oh, well, this was great. I've been listening a long time. You guys do a great job. Keep up the great work. I'm available whenever you're really scraping for a guest. Let me know. So
you just answered my next question. Like you haven't been scared off. You'll come back.
Oh no, this was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this.
Same.
Absolutely.
How can people find you if they want to?
Well, I'm at, I'm still on what was used to be known as Twitter, but I'm also on Blue Sky as Dr. Pop Culture USA, not BGSU anymore, Dr. Pop Culture USA, where I've got too much time and posting too many things. So
don't stop because I look for you every morning.
Oh, good, good. And that's where I am.
Excellent. You can find us on social media at GoGoCheckPod. You can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can find us back here next week. You can visit the Brown Pop Culture Library at Bowling Green State University if you're in town. And I already said you can find us right back here next week, but it's true.
Yeah, definitely.
Chuck, do you know how we end the show?
Smile, you're on candid camera.
Yes, exactly.
From now on.
Right, yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Mr. Wind, just keep us sailing.
Keep us sailing along.
High in the sky, there's no curtain.
Yes, we'll have fun. So everyone, come on.
Hey,
you on the ground.
Take a look up and see what we found.
Nothing to tie us. Bluebirds come up to guide us.
You're beside me, we can